Welcome to Biodiversity Speaks. I am Dr. Helena Jolly, a scientist who studies human-nature relationships and your host today at yet another fabulous episode of Biodiversity Speaks. Today, we have a speaker who studies species phylogeny. For our listeners who are wondering what that is, it is a study of the evolutionary history of the species. Through his work on relationships among broad groups of organisms, he tries to document how human-driven changes in environment are impacting these evolutionary orders. Please welcome Professor Jonathan Davis, a biodiversity scientist, cross-appointed in the departments of botany, forest and conservation sciences at the University of British Columbia. He explores how phylogeny of species help us learn about the present-day ecologies and how human actions are impacting them. Professor Davis was a coordinating lead author on the biodiversity section of the recent United Nations Environmental Programme Global Environment Outlook Report, Healthy Planet, Healthy People. At UBC, he is a member of the Biodiversity Research Center and the Interdisciplinary Biodiversity Solutions Program. He is also an associate member of the African Center of DNA Barcoding at the University of Johannesburg, South Africa, where he has been collaborating with scholars for more than a decade. Hello, Jonathan. Welcome to Biodiversity Speaks. I am very excited to have you here. Thank you for taking your time.
Thank you so much for the invitation. I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
This is the first time I'm having an evolutionary biologist at the studio. Even though my work aligns strongly to interdisciplinary research, my fundamental training has been in zoology. And I still remember the first time I heard the term evolutionary biology, which was when I first learned about Charles Darwin and Galapagos Island and all those things. Compared to ecology and conservation sciences, this field of science, the evolutionary biology, was rather unique. So how did you get interested in this field?
Oh, that's an interesting question, because I feel like many things in my life, my path has been rather random, and I've looked to just take what opportunities have come along somewhat. My undergraduate degree was in zoology, and I followed that up with a master's degree in conservation biology. And conservation was really my primary interest. And I took a break after my master's degree and worked in the city in London in an office, which was fine. And at some point, I realized I was getting very bored with the day-to-day job. And I thought, when was the last time I was really engaged and interested in the work I was doing? And I thought, well, that was when I was doing my master's degree. And so I ended up going back and doing a PhD, went back to academia. I just sort of drifted more into the evolutionary theory, evolutionary biology, and it wasn't intentional. I think it was because I found it just so intuitive. It's like those great ideas that seem so obvious in hindsight, that was how evolutionary theory was to me. As soon as it was explained to me, I thought, oh, that's so obvious. Why didn't I think of that? And those to me are signals of like really great ideas. I love that. I love learning things which seem obvious in hindsight.
Wonderful. What was your PhD research on?
Oh, it was on the diversity of angiosperms. These are flowering plants, and why we have so many different species of flowering plants and why some areas are more species rich than others. And I was looking at this from an evolution perspective, because we can think about the long history over sort of many millennia that has generated this diversity. And so we can think of a process of speciation extinction happening over millions of years, and maybe differences in those evolutionary rates, speciation extinction rates, could explain why some regions have more species of flowering plants than others. And we can think of like the tropics as super species rich. Why are there so many plants in the tropics? Maybe because plants there have been speciating at faster rates over tens of millions of years. And I was trying to tease apart the different drivers, different explanations of why we might see more species in some areas than others. And in fact, this links to later work that I was involved with in South Africa. In the Cape region in South Africa, there's this biome called the Fynbos, which is super diverse as the tropics, but it's far from the tropics. And it's like one of our ecological and evolutionary mysteries. How can this region in the wrong place be as diverse as the wet tropics? And again, I was looking at these evolutionary explanations for this. Maybe species go extinct at slower rates there. Maybe there's something magic in the environment that just really facilitates the rate species involved. So maybe evolution's just happening faster there.
That's really brilliant, Professor. So do you think there is a kind of a correlation between biodiversity hotspots and the speciation rate in those areas?
There must be in some way that the regions most species rich in the world must have accumulated that diversity somehow, and the fundamental processes generating diversity are speciation and extinction. And sometimes we refer to the alternative ways you can accumulate diversity as sort of a museum of diversity where things go extinct very slowly. So you add lots of old species, they accumulate over time. Then you can have a cradle of diversity where speciation is very rapid and you have lots of young species and they build up very quickly. And so there's a big puzzle whether the tropics represents this museum of diversity, which is looking after all these old species, or whether it's a cradle of diversity where things happen very rapidly. I mean, the answer is probably a bit of both, but it's been a debate in the literature for several decades now. And it's one of those questions that every few years there's a new paper which says we've solved the debate, and of course we never do.
This is really interesting. I can almost imagine you in the field, like collecting samples and, you know, working with them. Which brings to my next question, actually. I'm really curious to understand that in earlier days, when we talk about evolutionary biologists, the image that we have is this person going on this extensive field works, working meticulously, documenting, drawing pictures, very extensive field-based scientific inquiry. Is it still the same? Because now we have a lot of technology interventions, right? We have DNA barcoding, genetic profiling. From your experience, has something significantly changed in the role of this book of science?
I think there's a stereotype of evolutionary biologists today chained to a lab desk, pipettes in hand, busy grinding up some sort of material and then sequencing it and looking at the bases on a gene and looking for mutations and mutations linked maybe to a particular trait. And there's certainly really exciting work along those lines of evolutionary biology. We're getting these ideas of how single mutation events can lead to important phenotypic changes. And there's other sorts of advances, such as the development of CRISPR that allows us to move around gene regions, DNA regions, allows us to test these evolutionary hypotheses. But there's also still many people going out into the field. I should add here, I'm a terrible field biologist. I shouldn't be allowed into the field on my own. I know what the field looks like. I know where it is, but I need company when I'm out there. And so that's part of my collaborations I have. But many evolutionary biologists are going out there in the field, measuring things, collecting data. And to do that, you've got to be also a natural historian. You've got to be able to recognize the species you're interested in. You've got to be able to recognize unusual features in the natural environment. And so I think that sort of dichotomy of field biologists versus evolutionary biologists is much more of a gradation than you might think. And lots of field biologists out there doing experiments or doing field work. Often we bring stuff back to the lab. I certainly do that. And I'm also, I don't know how I got this far in my career, because I'm also terrible in the lab. I'm terrible in the field, terrible in the lab. I'm in this strange in-between position where I have, fortunately, amazing collaborators that help me in the field, and also amazing collaborators that help me do my genomic sequencing in the lab.
That is really fascinating. I can't believe that you are a terrible field scientist.
Oh, it's true. I love being out there, but I need supervision.
Maybe to an extent, since you're talking very strongly about, you know, you not being a strong field scientist, but I do know that being in the field is a very hard journey. And as an evolutionary biologist, it's not easy, you know, collecting, documenting and understanding species in rough terrains or difficult terrains and doing that. But most of these findings from evolutionary biologists often have very great relevance in biological conservation or biodiversity conservation discussions. But very few people know about that. So, Professor, tell us, how would the knowledge of species and their evolutionary trajectory improve biodiversity science and conservation? Can you explain this to our audience?
There's interest in the process by which biodiversity was generated, and maybe that's less relevant for conservation practice. But I think we're all fascinated by biodiversity, by the diversity of life, the different forms and functions of species. And we just want to know about how that diversity came about. And everything from how kids love going to the zoo and seeing different species. And I feel there's something intrinsic that draws us to biodiversity in the natural world. And we just love to, we want to find out about more about it. And evolutionary biology can help provide those insights. And I feel like the more we know and understand about biodiversity, the more we can treasure it. And we should appreciate these aspects of biodiversity more. And I think that engenders this idea that we also need to protect it more. Because once you understand it and you realize that the species we see today are a product of these millions of years of evolutionary history. The evolution has been blind. It's not like these species had to happen, but this is amazingly complex, very slow, or not always slow. It can happen in rapid bursts with long periods where nothing much happens at all. But the life we see today is this product of this very complex process that's accumulated over millions of years, and it's precious. So we need to really value that biodiversity to make people want to protect it. And I think by giving them this more information to understand how amazing it is, they'll want to protect it more. At least that's my hope.
You made such a wonderful point, Professor. In this present world, we see that human actions have had an irreversible consequence on everything, like including biodiversity, climate, natural resources. So as an evolutionary biologist, how has human actions negatively impacted the biodiversity from a phylogenetic perspective? We all know that human-induced species loss is real, and I believe these may have some long-term consequence on the tree of life. So in your work, have you witnessed something that is worth highlighting?
So a lot of my work has been focused on how extinction prunes branches from the tree of life. And the tree of life is this evolutionary history that connects all living organisms. All species have a position on the tree of life. We are on the tree of life when we're next door to chimpanzees. This is just a tiny twig on the tree of life. But every species has a position on that tree of life. And the time since it diverged from its nearest neighbor is the amount of unique evolutionary history we have that no other species has. And with every extinction event, we lose that unique evolutionary history.
Wow, I've never thought of evolutionary biology from this particular angle, and it's really fascinating. Most of us are often familiar with these names of prominent evolutionary biologists, right, like Darwin or Wallace or Ed Wilson, who are also conservation scientists. But I have noticed in the recent period that conservation discussions or biodiversity discussion is mostly dominated by certain sector of, you know, certain field of people like ecologists, environmental ecologists or economists and animal behavioral scientists, with less representation from evolutionary scientists. So why do you think over years the appreciation for evolutionary biologists in these discussions have reduced? And I also have a quick follow-up question following that is, and based on your experience and observation, do you think this trend has or may have some long-term impact on global biodiversity conservation?
I think there are, in fact, good reasons why evolutionary biologists have been left out of the discussion in conservation biology in recent times. And this is because there's now growing appreciation that we're in this sort of crisis area where we are just trying to stem the tide of biodiversity loss. And evolutionary biologists are often thought to think about processes happening over long term. But the rate we are losing biodiversity is so rapid that there's no time to think about those slower processes. What we have to do immediately is try to reduce some of the pressures on biodiversity. And that has left evolutionary biologists out of the discussion. But I think it's still a priority that we address the pressures first before we think about sort of restoring some of these biodiversity features where evolutionary components become more important. So we need to reduce the rates of emissions of greenhouse gases, to reduce the pressure from climate change. We need to stop the rate of deforestation and habitat loss and degradation. We need to reduce our pollution into the environment. We need to reduce the rate we are exploiting natural species through fishing and hunting. These are the big drivers of biodiversity loss. And biodiversity science can't persist or continue and develop until we have removed those pressures, there's nothing we can do in terms of conservation until we reduce those pressures. And that's almost more of a political discussion that needs to happen, and those processes need to be addressed. And then we can think about developing biodiversity science, including evolutionary concepts, which are fundamentally important to species evolutionary and, or not even evolutionary, but species long-term futures, or even, and sometimes just short-term futures. If we are looking at a world which is now committed to continuous climate change over the next few decades, species need to be able to adapt to that. And part of that adaptation requires the genetic diversity evolutionary processes that allow them to adapt to that change. So there's lots of different features of global change that are happening, and evolution is a key feature, a key process that's going to allow species to persist through that change. And once you have removed the pressures, the direct drivers of biodiversity loss, I think we've got to start thinking about which populations, which genotypes are going to be important. Do we maximize the total genetic diversity of population? Do we try to identify the genetic features which are going to be most important for climate adaptation? These are all really key questions that we'll need to address once we've got ourselves out of the immediate crisis. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think we've lost anything yet, but I think evolutionary biologists have a lot to contribute to the discussion going forward. But there's some hard political and economic questions that have to be addressed, which are driving that biodiversity loss before conservation biology can be useful in that more sort of conceptual theoretical sense in terms of how do we preserve species going forward. And that's where evolutionary biologists can have a useful contribution.
That's really interesting. And also, Professor, at this point, it's also very fascinating to note that you also played some significant role and contributed some major discussions into like the policy making and like on global level at United Nations Environmental Program. How did that happen, and what were the contributions to that particular study?
I was contacted by researchers involved in the program with the United Nations looking to find people working on land degradation and looking for recommendations. And I guess because my publications are out there, my emails out there, and so I'm sure they were going through, trawling through a whole bunch of people. And so I got involved purely accidentally, and it was eye-opening and also a little scary to be involved in these big international assessment processes. The researchers who are involved in it are so committed and putting in so much work and believe in what they are doing. And there's just a feeling that the process of change is so slow, that you're fighting this immovable object. And there's been a series of global assessments and biodiversity reports and sort of reports on the climate change, and they're giving a very consistent message. I worry that we become too good at writing these reports and generating these assessments and not good enough at making change happen. Mm. And that's a real struggle for me. And I could see that in this assessment process I got involved with.
Yeah, I can completely understand. Like, we generate so much of written materials and documents. As also scientists, we have so many publications come in, and very few of them actually come into like the mainstream political or like policy-based discussions. And it's just a shame. But I'm happy that, you know, you learned something through this experience. And it actually brings to my next particular point, which I wanted to discuss. Throughout the podcast, you've been talking about like how you're not a great field researcher and you've been valuing your collaborators in the field very much. And in one of our previous conversations, you mentioned that you are an associate member at African Center for DNA Barcoding at the University of Johannesburg, South Africa. Tell us about what, and what was that work about, and what are the interesting things that you do there?
Oh, it's been an absolute privilege working there. People there are great. And every time I go to South Africa, sort of pre-COVID, used to go once or twice a year. And I love it, love working there. The environment is fantastic. The researchers, again, so committed, so interested. And South Africa has also got this amazing biodiversity. And it's fortunate among many sub-Saharan African countries that it's relatively wealthy too. And it's committed to, well, maybe not politically, but the researchers there are invested in conservation, and you can see some really excellent conservation science happening there. And the students are just really excited about contributing to this too, which is really nice to see. I got involved with the African Center for Barcoding because they actually invited me to help contribute and help supervise students there.
So far, can you describe one of the most fascinating experiences working with Center for African DNA Barcoding?
Sure. There's some really important work recently looking at the distribution of biodiversity knowledge, including the identity of species, the genetic sequence that exists for species, the trait data, what those species look like in their ecological function, and how well conserved or threatened they are, and that looking at their distribution across space in South Africa, and how well the current reserve system captures those different dimensions of diversity. One of the findings of this, which was a relief, was that, in fact, the reserves will perform as well, if not slightly better, in the future. And so it appears that species are moving into reserves as they are shifting with climate. And there are various reasons for this we can hypothesize about, one of which is reserves are often placed in areas of the world or the landscape which aren't that great for farming, say, or development. And so the reserve system has sort of accidentally been designed to be good for the future, which was a really nice result. And so that was just one project that was led by a student I co-supervised, University of Johannesburg, Lerato, who did all the, she was so fun to work with, did all these species distribution models for tens of thousands of species. And at the start of the project, I was like, this is going to be impossible. You can't do this. And then she just went ahead and did it anyhow. Yeah. You know, that's why you should never listen to your supervisor. And say, it can't be done. She just did it. And it was great. And we just published the last paper from her PhD earlier this year. And that was a really fun project because it was dealing with a really important question. Currently, I'm working on the sort of barcode of South African trees. And this is a project which I'm trying to integrate information on the uses people put to trees. And so often there's this clustering on the tree of life for uses, except for cultural uses. And those were not randomly, but evenly or unevenly distributed across the whole tree of life. There's something we couldn't identify, at least as I couldn't identify as a scientist, that meant that some trees had this extra cultural value, which wasn't practical in a sense. And there's also something special about the trait, we call it, that, you know, that associated with this cultural value, which we can't explain.
That's really interesting because when we think of species or phylogeny, we always think of the traits as a very physical thing, right? Do you think we'll be able to incorporate like a cultural trait, especially for like trees and plants which are used by indigenous communities?
Oh, I think so. And I'm very liberal in what I call a trait. And so anything I can associate with the species, I'm happy to call a trait. And I think we are missing many of these non-economic values, especially in terms of big industry values like timber production, which they're pretty easy to put a dollar amount on. We're missing the values that other cultures assign to species, and whether it's trees or whatever organism. And there we're missing that sort of ecosystem accounting. And I think there's been a big move to try to incorporate that as we go forward and appreciate the contributions of species to people.
That would be very useful because at this point we are like conserving it mostly from the very economic point of view, but like bringing those cultural traits would be really interesting to see conservation from a different dimension, right?
I think so. And I mean, linked to the fact that the cultural and spiritual values people assigned to the trees of South Africa were so dispersed across the phylogeny. If we prioritized those attributes for conservation, we'd actually be capturing more of the tree of life, more of the phylogeny, than if we prioritized more physical properties. And so, incidentally, from my very like Western science point of view, let's value these processes and prioritize the richest or whatever. But if we took into account those cultural values, I'm maximizing my phylogenetic diversity.
Oh, that's really interesting. And if you are planning to do that project in a larger scale, I would love to join you on the field to South Africa.
We'd have to have some helpers out in the field, as I say. I shouldn't be on my own or guiding people into the field.
And talking to you about the collaboration and collaborative work you've been doing, Professor, we often know that collaborative sciences between Global South and Global North has historically not been all fair and right. And as a scholar from North America, especially a white male scientist, you must be familiar with the discourses of parachute science. How do you thread these paths of collaboration doing science while acknowledging your privilege and positionality?
Yeah, that's a big question, especially now. These days I've become more conscious of this. And I was thinking when I first started collaborating with South Africa, maybe 15 years ago, my colleagues there, this issue was less part of the mainstream conservation. And honestly, I didn't really think about it too much. I was just super excited to work there. I was invited. Maybe that's an important distinction here. I was invited by my collaborators, who weren't my collaborators, in South Africa, to assist them. They had a project, students working on this project, and they were looking at these phylogenetic questions, and they reached out to me and said, will you help and help co-supervise these students? And I was like, this sounds amazing. Of course, I'd love to. And I went over there, and we've established a very strong relationship since. So I hope it's a win-win situation. And subsequently, over the last 15 years, I have had a couple of students from Canada who have worked in South Africa doing some really interesting projects, always associated with the University of Johannesburg. And so it's always part of a team between the Canadian Institute and the South African Institute. And I always have students from both universities. When it's my research, I always have students from University of Johannesburg involved in the field too, and they're involved in the research. And what I try to do is really encourage them to take a lead role in that. And what I can help assist with the students there, where the university system differs a little bit from Western Europe and North America, I can help them navigate the sort of academic game in a way. I've now had lots of experience in submitting papers and working through the editorial system and writing cover letters and responses to reviewers and so on. I can help them navigate that path, which can be complex, can be, if you're not got experience in it, it can be very inhibiting for you to make progress. So I've thought about my role, and I try to make sure that I'm giving more than I'm taking, and I'm not sure if I always achieve that goal, but that's my aim. And I like that academic exchange. And I think that partnership is, we're treated as equals, but we give and receive different things. And so as long as I feel that's true, that I can contribute something useful, I'd continue. And again, if I wasn't feeling that I was invited and being useful to them, I probably wouldn't go. It's been a process of, in the field and working with them, process of learning the whole time. And I think it's a mistake to think or go in there thinking you know stuff already. To go in there, eyes wide open, and I'm constantly learning.
Yeah, you've articulated the whole thing really beautifully, Professor. And this portion about win-win that you mentioned, that got me thinking. Because when we think of collaboration between scholars from the Global North and South, we have this cliched image of, Western scientists correcting the local knowledge. Is that always true? And from your experience, you just mentioned that it's not always true. And so if I were to ask you, what were some of the things that you learned from your experience in South Africa, some sort of an unlearning of your conventional science training?
That's an interesting question. Yeah, so I wouldn't say it's an unlearning process. I'd say it's a constant learning process. Again, I think the biggest mistake you can have, I think, is going into a system thinking you know the answer, how it works. This is across any science, I think. Yeah. Because inevitably, that's going to lead you astray and you're going to be wrong. And so I am constantly learning about the ecosystem in Africa. There was this amazing project I was involved with about underground trees, which I had no idea they existed or even what they were.
Underground trees.
And so we call this the underground forests of Africa. And so in fire-prone landscapes, trees are very vulnerable to burns, and there are different strategies you can do. You can have to escape them. You could have very thick bark. You could grow tall and get out of that sort of fire danger zone, or you can retreat underground. And there's a whole bunch of trees that do just that. And
I didn't know that such a tree exists.
So all the big woody stem, the sort of trunk in inverted commas, is underground, and every year they sprout leaves, flower, fruit above ground, and they die back in, or they get burnt out when the fire comes through. And obviously people have known about these underground trees forever, you know, as long as people have been around that landscape. To me, I was like, there's underground trees? Like, what are they doing? When do they come about? There's all this information out there that we're completely ignorant to. And unless we go there and we listen to people, we're never going to discover it. And I mean, this is just like one tiny example.
This has been really a wonderful discussion, Professor, and I have learned so much about evolutionary biology and its importance in biological conservation. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. If you want to hear more from Biodiversity Speaks, you can follow us on our socials at iBios Program on Twitter and Instagram handles. This episode is hosted by me, Helena Jolly, edited by Liam Reed, and assisted by Emma Jarek Simard. We'll be back in a couple of weeks. But until we meet again, think of how our connections, history, and evolutionary pathways, how these play such a key role in maintaining this natural world as we see it.